Due to the nature of the topic this morning, I will not be speaking. I'll just be tweeting my main points. So if you could get ready now. The way the schedule for the week is laid out, right? We start off in the beginning of the week with the sort of core theoretical issues in value theory, price theory, methodology, business cycle theory, and so on. And then as we move throughout the week, we tend to incorporate more applied applied or secondary topics. And this, of course, is one of them, right? The purpose this morning is not to generate new theory in the Austrian tradition, but rather to apply what we've learned so far in the week to a particular set of issues dealing with technology, particularly the economics of networks, economics of information, economics of technical standards and related issues. Why have a lecture on that? Well, it turns out that within the last 10 years, maybe 15 years, there have been a lot of scholars and also popular critics who have, looked at some important structural changes going on in the economy over the last decade or so, the rise of the internet in particular, and said, well, there seems to be an economic model of production or a model of economic organization in this new networked knowledge-based economy that looks different from the model that was employed in, sort of the old economy, the manufacturing economy. So maybe some of those theories and principles developed not only by Austrians but by other economists as well don't apply anymore, right? That maybe the sort of stuff you learn in your basic economics classes, that's the analysis of the old economy, but the analysis of the new economy or the knowledge economy requires a whole different set of theories and concepts and tools, and we need to throw the old ones away and develop some new ones, right? Moreover, the kinds of policy prescriptions that Austrian economists and many other economists would make about the advantages of market competition and the drawbacks of central planning and so on, those don't apply either. Right? So according to many of these critics, there's a new and more important role for the state in directing economic activity because of these new, technological characteristics. So I want to talk about that a little bit. What do people mean when they talk about the new economy, or sometimes they use the term the knowledge economy or the knowledge-based economy? Well, if you look around at Western economies, you see some interesting and somewhat novel characteristics. Right. So, for example, everybody is interested in networks, right? The internet as a network of networks, social networking, Facebook and Twitter and so on, firms being involved in loose collaborations with other firms, being part of a particular consortium or network of like-minded firms. They don't compete with each other in exactly the same way. They cooperate in certain different ways. A lot of people point to intangible rather than tangible assets as a source of value in the new or knowledge-based economy, right? So the idea there is, well, in the old economy of the 19th century or most of the 20th century, the key to value and profit for a firm is, machines, factories, land, equipment, a big labor force, right? Tangible resources. Now they argue, you look at a company like, an IT company or a biotech company, and, they don't have a lot of physical plant, right? Their primary assets are intangible information, knowledge about proprietary business methods, intellectual property, the knowledge capital of their employees. So people say you don't need a big building, you don't need machines and factories anymore to be profitable and to create value. You need reputation, knowledge, information, positioning in a network, and so on. Intangibles are more important than they used to be. Other people have pointed to, the relative sizes of the manufacturing versus the service sectors in Western economies, right? Say, well, in the U.S., a greater proportion of output, a greater proportion of labor and so on is in the service sector relative to the manufacturing sector. Manufacturing is not important anymore. That's not a source of economic growth, right? We source that out to people in the third world, developing countries in Asia, maybe in Africa and so on. And here in a country like the U.S., we concentrate on providing services like lawsuits, right? We excel at suing each other and we let, developing countries actually produce stuff. Other observers have noticed the rise in sort of what you might call new forms of organization, new forms of business organization, like an open source network, for example. So they say, well, Microsoft Windows, you know, that's produced using an old model, you know, a sort of hierarchical model. So you have, you know, Steve Ballmer at the top, and then you have a bunch of employees, you have programmers, they're employed by Microsoft, they're paid to write code, somebody assembles it and coordinates it and packages it and tries to sell it and make money. Linux, on the other hand, right, doesn't have that kind of hierarchical structure. It's produced by volunteers who contribute their time and effort out of, perhaps, it is alleged, intrinsic motivation, though there's some problems there, and the result is some sort of spontaneously ordered product. You know, again, compare the Encyclopedia Britannica and Wikipedia, right? The idea that Wikipedia is produced by this new organizational form, a new means of production that, you know, wouldn't have been feasible in the old days, but now because of IT, information technology, the internet, and so on, we have this much more decentralized, disaggregated way of producing stuff. Some scholars and critics have argued that this model may generalize to producing lots of things. You know, maybe you can produce cars as open source products. Maybe we can make food, you know, in the Wikipedia style, and that we ought to be paying more attention to that. I'll say, have a little bit more to say about that later. And finally, some have looked at changes in the way firms compete with each other. So this goes a little bit back to the idea of networks. There was a book by Dixit and Nailbuff that came out about 10 years ago called Coopetition. They said, well, it used to be that firms could either compete or they could cooperate, but now they simultaneously compete and cooperate. They co-opete? I'm not sure. The noun is coopetition. I got to think about what the verb is. But the idea is that, you know, these sort of old models of oligopoly or competition, perfect competition or rivalrous engagement between firms, that's not what firms do anymore. They're in these much more complex kind of relationships. And we need new theories to explain that. Some of the literature, so the point is, you know, given all this, do we need some kind of new economic theories? Is regular economics, in particular regular Austrian economics, you know, is it still useful? Some important literature, there were two books that came out in, I think they both came out in 98, one serious and one silly. Okay, the serious book is called Information Rules by Shapiro and Varian, which I recommend to you. It's an excellent book that applies basic, mostly neoclassical, but basic economic theory to sort of network and communication issues. Then a rather silly book by Kevin Kelly called New Rules for the New Economy, kind of a pop book, both of which analyzed, in particular, online markets and so-called information goods, right? So when you're transacting online, as in eBay or Amazon or these sort of B2B, business-to-business exchanges, that the way firms compete is different from the way they do in sort of brick-and-mortar competition. And they also focus, the Varian book in particular, on the buying and selling of information, such as a directory or you know, the Google Cache. That's an asset that is purely, the value of it is information. How do you buy and sell information? There have also been more recently some books on that focus more on networks. A rather silly book called Wikinomics that I would recommend if you want to laugh, but it's the analysis is not very good in my opinion, by Tapscott and Williams. And then a more serious book by Yochai Benkler at Yale called The Wealth of Networks. I wrote a review of this for the Independent Review last year if you want to look at that. But these are examples of some of the literature that's asking these questions and making these challenges and critiques. Yeah, I mean, Chris Anderson is best known for his book, The Long Tail, and his newest book is called Free. I don't actually have a quote from Anderson, but I have a quote on the same idea, which I want to challenge a little bit. So this Kevin Kelly book, this gives you a flavor of the kinds of things that people were saying in the late 90s. Now, what's going on in the tech sector in the late 90s? Boom, right? So this is before the crash of the tech bubble. So Kelly says, the very best gets cheaper each year. Okay, well, I mean, some of that may be true. This rule of thumb is so ingrained in our contemporary lifestyle that we bank on it without marveling at it. But marvel we should, because this paradox, although he hasn't identified a paradox yet, this paradox is a major engine of the new economy. These are my highlights here. Through most of the industrial age, consumers experienced slight improvements in quality for slight increases in price. That's probably true. But the arrival of the microprocessor flipped the price equation. In the information age, consumers quickly came to count on drastically superior quality for less price over time. The price and quality curves diverge so dramatically that it sometimes seems as if the better something is, the cheaper it will cost. Because the implication is, you know, in the old days, as product quality improved, you know, if you want a fancier, if you want a Mercedes, you got to pay more than to get a, you know, Toyota. But now, the fancier, the better, the higher the quality something is, the less it costs. So, you know, instead of the old way we would draw demand curves or how we would shift the demand curve for an increase in product quality, now we have to do it the opposite way, or maybe the demand curve slopes up, or higher quality, you shift the demand curve to the left instead of to the right. What's wrong with that? What's the confusion here? Yeah, I mean, he's confusing improvements in quality over time with willingness to pay at a moment in time, right? I mean, so it's true that, you know, whatever an entry-level car would be, a Honda Civic or something, you know, is vastly greater than a model, you know, a Model T Ford. Okay, so products are better over getting better over time, and in some sectors, particularly in the tech sector, we've seen prices fall over time. Right, but that doesn't mean that at a moment in time, for a given set of preferences and a given state of technological knowledge, that the better something is, the less it costs. It's not like right now I can buy a Mercedes for half the price of a Honda, okay? So I mean, this is just muddled thinking. Really hyperbole to try to sell books. This came from the Dallas Fed's 1999 annual report, which is an interesting source. You can still find it online, of sort of new economy hyperbole, and these are serious, you know, thinkers supposedly who are writing this. I like this sentence. Scarcity, the first assumption of the old economy, isn't the dominant feature of the new economy. Okay, so what you learned about, you know, human beings choosing among alternative scarce means to achieve their ends, you know, none of that applies anymore. Scarcity isn't important. Many of today's markets are awash with goods and services. Well, that's true. Do we have an infinite number of goods and services? Not the last time I checked. Sellers compete aggressively for buyers, they discount, they cut costs, they expand markets. Yeah, I mean, that's all true, but I wouldn't exactly throw out scarcity when I went and did my economic analysis. Here's another one of these quotes about the, you know, increasing returns. Increasing returns to scale pervade the new economy. We'll talk about that a little bit. More of today's companies and economies thrive on quantity discounts. That's true. The higher the demand, the lower the price. I'm not exactly sure what they mean here. If by the higher the demand, they mean shifting the market demand curve to the right. It's not clear to me how that would result in a lower price. There's a funky looking supply curve. Yeah. Maybe they mean quantity demanded even, so they either mean a downward sloping supply curve or an upward sloping demand curve or something. It's not spelled out exactly what they mean. I think they're just trying to sell annual reports. You know, decreasing returns to scale dominated the old economy, so producing more goods and services pushed prices up. Well, again, I mean, it's true that there are increasing returns to scale for the production of many goods and services. You know, it's not like this is the first time we've ever thought about returns to scale. I mean, there's a big section in Man, Economy, and State, and you go back to Alfred Marshall, even Bombavik talks a little bit about this. I mean, this is hardly something new in the economy. Which brings me to sort of one of my first points about, you know, all the stuff that's new, is it really all that new? How new is the new economy? And I would argue, not very new. Okay, not very new at all. You know, for example, people say, well, you know, it used to be to get your ideas across, you had to publish a book. And I think Gary North engaged in a little bit of hyperbole in his discussion on this topic too, that, you know, now you don't have to be a publisher, right? You don't have to be McGraw-Hill. Anybody can publish their stuff on the web. You can blog your stuff. You can tweet your stuff, whatever. Well, I mean, that's true, but if you think of, you know, the American Revolution, for example, and the amount of propaganda, in the neutral sense of the word propaganda, that was distributed by pamphlet, by, you know, the town crier, through informal meetings and so on. So, I mean, it's always been the case that people have had means of distributing information at low cost by writing letters, by distributing cheap, low-cost pamphlets, and so on. Again, we can do that a lot more cheaply now, and you can reach more people more easily with a web page than you can with a pamphlet. There's no doubt about it. But this idea of trying to circumvent the established providers of information through sort of back channels, that in itself is by no means a new phenomenon. The internet's new, of course. Don't dispute that at all. On the other hand, a lot of its characteristics are not entirely new either. It's a really interesting book. I should have brought the cover of it called, came out about 2000, I think, called The Victorian Internet. Anybody heard of that? The Victorian Internet? It's about the telegraph machine, which emerged and was diffused widely in the mid to late 19th century. It's a fascinating book because the emergence of the telegraph network brought with it a lot of the exact same characteristics as that we saw with the emergence of the internet, and all these sort of crazy statements people are making about the end of scarcity and so on. They were making them back then too. They were saying, well, the telegraph has completely revolutionized society. It's changed the way we interact with each other. You know, distance no longer means anything. Now you can communicate. Old information gatekeepers are no longer important. There's a whole discussion in the book about the sort of the geeky subculture of the telegraph. You know, telegraph operators, they had nicknames, they communicated with each other, they had the equivalent of bulletin boards, and, you know, I mean, their own language, and I mean, it's really very interesting. But the idea of a diffuse communications network is not brand new either. Before the Yahoo directory or the Google archive, we had the phone book, and we had guidebooks, and, maps and all kinds of other products that are designed to list and describe and characterize information. Okay, I'll talk a little bit more later about so-called information goods, right? So people say, well, if you're selling information, that's totally different from selling tangible goods and services. Yeah, but we've had information goods around for a long time. They're called books. Okay, and when you buy a book, you're typically not just buying the paper. You're buying the information that is contained within the book. We know a lot about how you buy and sell books and other sources of information. there's been a lot of attention in the innovation literature to the adoption and diffusion of various kinds of information technology, mainframe computers, and then personal computers, and now, you know, cell phones, PDAs, the growth of networks like Facebook and Twitter and so on. And, you know, there's a lot of attention to these adoption curves, a famous so-called S-curve that characterizes the typical pattern of adoption for something new like this. You know, in the beginning, not many people use it. There are a few early adopters, and then there's some momentum built. And then all of a sudden, everybody's using it, and there's only a few people left who aren't using it. I mean, think about Facebook, right? It completely follows this sort of a pattern, and now we're way up here, apparently, on the Facebook town. I'm told that for people under 30 are not using Facebook anymore. It's like people over 50 who are the major adopters now. And I guess if you're young, you don't want to be in a social network that your grandma is also on. So people are switching to something else. Typically this is it's either the accumulated production of the thing, if it's like a PC, or it could be the number of users. Right, it's some measure of how widely this thing has penetrated the market. Interestingly enough, there are a lot of studies in the history of innovation looking at old technologies like electricity, right? When electricity began to be available in the late 19th, early 20th centuries, the automobile, refrigerators, washing machines, telephones, VCRs. If you plot their adoption rates, they look almost exactly like the adoption rate curves that you find for these new innovations. Whereas the idea that something new comes along and there are a few enthusiasts who try it, and then gradually a few more people start to use it, and then there's this cumulative effect, and everybody starts using it, and then within a short period of time almost everybody has it. These older innovations were adopted in almost exactly the same way. Okay, so this is hardly a new phenomenon that we don't know much about. The Benkler book, called The Wealth of Networks, he focuses a lot on this kind of Wikipedia model, what he calls commons-based peer production. Right, so it's commons-based in the sense that the output, the intellectual property is not owned by a particular firm or a particular individual. Right, it's like the commons, as you know the phrase tragedy of the commons, right? Something that's sort of owned collectively. And it's mostly produced by peers in sort of horizontal relationships, not subordinates and superiors, but rather it's, you know, peer-to-peer kind of production. And Bengler emphasizes, or he claims in the book, that this model of commons-based peer production is A, well, he doesn't claim it's brand new, but he claims it's, it was never very important before. Now it's becoming much more important, and maybe it will end up being the dominant production model in lots of other parts of the economy as well. I mean, right now, right, despite a lot of excitement and attention or even hype over things like, you know, Linux and Wikipedia and so on, I mean, that's a pretty small part of the economy, right? The vast majority of goods and services are produced by the old model and, so-called old model, and Bengler thinks that the new model will eventually possibly take over. Well, I mean, this idea of commons-based peer production, I wonder if Bengler has ever read iPencil by Leonard Reed. Okay, I mean, what is the market if not a giant kind of commons-based peer production network? Okay, it's not technically open source in the same way, but I mean, the whole idea of the coordinating properties of the market, right, in Reed's brilliant essay, iPencil, which if you've never read, of course, you should read it, you know, 5 or 6 times in a row, explains how individuals who are largely anonymous to each other, they don't know each other, none of them has the objective of producing, you know, the pencil, but their actions, the actions of thousands, even millions of people interact and coordinate in such a way that even something as simple as a pencil, right, has, you know, thousands and thousands of steps and subcomponents and components of those components and inputs to those inputs and so on, and it's done without any central planning, without any central coordination. Well, commons-based peer production is really just another version of that. Okay, a little bit more about information. There are a lot of misconceptions about how information is bought and sold. I mean, the first thing to emphasize, right, is that information is a consumer good, just like any other consumer good. Why is that? Because remember, what we buy and sell is not, you know, sort of information in some broad generic sense. No, what is bought and sold on the market is specific, discrete units of information that are embodied in something. Okay, so if you subscribe to a newspaper, you're not buying information. You know, you're buying the newspaper and whatever bits of information are contained within it, right? And, you know, with information, you can choose to consume more of it or less of it. You evaluate marginal units of information according to your preference scale. You can decide to purchase or not to purchase them. So, at root, information is not all that different from other consumer goods. Now, on the other hand, it does have some sort of interesting properties. We'll talk about in just a second. I mentioned before, information goods aren't new. We've been buying and selling them for centuries. If you paid to attend Mises University, you'd be buying an information good, right? Now, on the other hand, the production of information goods is a little bit, it has some unusual properties that are worth studying. Not revolutionary, in my judgment, but still interesting. The main production feature, right, is this idea that, you know, there's sort of a high fixed cost and a low variable cost of production. In other words, if you look at Tom Wood's book Meltdown, right, the major production cost in producing copies of that book Meltdown, you know, it's not printing another copy and putting it in the mail. It's writing the book. Okay, so writing a book is hard. Once you've written a book, you know, making one more copy of it is pretty easy. Okay, so software is another great example of that, right? And people have argued that, well, it's hard for, you know, Microsoft, for example. You know, how are they going to make money selling their software, selling Windows? Okay, so, you know, they have to spend gazillions of dollars to hire the programmers to write the code. But once the code is written, the cost of producing just one more copy of Windows is, I mean, almost zero if you just download it. If you buy it on a CD, you know, the cost is like 20 cents. Cost of production to stamp the CD or whatever. I guess there's like $5 worth of paper packaging, though, that goes with that 20-cent CD. But anyway, the point is, if you think about firms producing goods and services and pricing them according to the marginal cost of production, then if you're, with these high fixed cost, low variable cost products, you're not going to make very much money, right? You have to charge more than the marginal cost of production to be able to cover that fixed cost of writing the code in the first place. So people say, well, we need a whole new production theory to account for this. Well, I mean, we have lots of ideas about how goods that have these characteristics can be produced. There's a lot of price discrimination, for example. Different versions of products that are, that cost about the same to produce, but are aimed at different segments of the market with different demand elasticities. Right, so a lot of software you can download the basic version for free. If you want the pro version, you have to pay $19.95 for it or something like that. I mean, that's a way of segmenting the market into different groups based on willingness to pay, elasticity of demand, and so on. There's a lot of two-part pricing, right? So two-part pricing is like, well, maybe you pay one price sort of to get in the door, so to speak, and then another price for using marginal units of the good. Classic example of that is like an amusement park where you pay one price for admission to the park, but then you have to pay for the rides. Some parks you have like tickets. You have to have a certain number of tickets per ride, right? So that's a way of capturing the willingness to pay of people just to get in the park, but then sort of discriminating among different attendees based on how much they want to ride the rides. Okay, so you see a lot of that in software in particular, that you give away you give away the base unit for free, and then you try to make money selling complementary products and services, like Acrobat would be an example, right? Or Flash. I mean, anybody can download a Flash player or Acrobat Reader, but to get the software to generate content using Flash, or in some cases Acrobat, you have to pay to get that to get that part. It's true that there is, these products are characterized by increasing returns, no doubt about it. And that often gives market incumbents kind of a competitive advantage in relation to newcomers. Okay, right, and the idea is like, if I wanted to compete with Google as a search engine, right, I mean, it would take me a long time to build up the database, the cache that Google has to compete head to head, let's say, in selling my services to advertisers, right? Because Google is already there, because it accumulated this large cache of information before I did, it has an advantage to me in the market. It can charge advertisers a higher rate than I can. Or to look at a consumer-based model, if I wanted to create an operating system, right? Microsoft has already incurred the expenditure to design Windows. I have to design my own operating system and compete with Microsoft in selling it. Well, Microsoft can price additional units of its product lower than what I can price mine because it's already made the investment in the code. Okay, it has some pricing flexibility that I lack. To make a long story short, in markets characterized by strong increasing returns, it's advantageous to be the first mover. Typically, there are strong first mover advantages. Therefore, incumbents, in many cases, have strategic advantages over new entrants. Not necessarily in all cases, and it doesn't mean that there is never any movement within the ranking of companies. Obviously, the fact that Google wasn't an incumbent in 2002 or whatever, it didn't stop it from becoming the dominant player. So there's a lot of movement in and out of these rankings of different tech firms. But yet a lot of people believe that once you're entrenched as the dominant tech firm in a sector, you can never be dislodged. And Microsoft can never be overthrown. Google can never be overthrown unless, of course, the state antitrust authorities or regulatory bodies step in and rescue consumers from being exploited. I want to say just a few words about network effects. Excuse me. because this has gotten a lot of attention in the literature. What do we mean by a network effect? Well, this is a very specific characteristic of markets in which people are connected through a network in some fashion. Right? And the idea of a network effect is imagine a good or service for which the value of consuming that good or service is a function of the number of other people that also consume that good or service. In other words, for many networks, the value of being in the network is a function of the size of the network. Okay, I mean, you don't want to be the only person in the world to have Facebook. It doesn't have much value to you if there's nobody on it or if nobody you know is on it. Okay, so the more people are on Facebook, the more valuable it is on the margin for you to join as well, because more of your friends are on there and so on. Okay, why is that important? Well, it is alleged that when for particular technologies or products that have this characteristic, that the value of the product depends on the size of the network, often the market competition will select kind of the wrong product as the dominant product. The wrong product is the dominant product. How so? Well, if you imagine, suppose there are two social networks, Facebook and MySpace. Let's assume that they're both brand new. You know, each one has just one user, the founder. Okay, so you come along, you want to join a social networking site, and you know that there are two sites, Facebook and MySpace, each of which has one user, so, and assume that you're completely indifferent between them as far as what the interface looks like. All you care about is you want to be on the one that has the most people on it. Right, so they both have one person, so maybe you just flip a coin, and let's say it comes up Facebook, and so you join Facebook. Okay, then the next person comes along, same situation. Now there's two people on Facebook, one person on MySpace. So that person says, well, I'd rather be on the network that has two people instead of one. So that person joins Facebook as well. Third person comes along, same thing. Fourth person, fifth person. All of a sudden, you know, several rounds later into this process, Facebook has this huge network and MySpace still just has one guy. Okay, it's a hypothetical, right? But notice that the fact that Facebook, in this example, ended up being the dominant social network, not because it was better somehow than the other one, not because it had better features or higher quality, just a coin flip, right? A purely random event led one product to be widely adopted and another product to be abandoned or shunned, okay? So a term that's used in the literature is path dependence, meaning that markets that are characterized by strong network effects, you get these path-dependent processes where the market kind of ends up going down one path where one particular technology emerges as the dominant technology, not because it's better, but because of some random events or some idiosyncratic features. And once you get stuck on that path, it's very difficult to get out of it. Right. In other words, now there's 1,000 people on Facebook and still just one person on MySpace. Right. Maybe the 1,000 people would be just as happy on MySpace as on Facebook if the whole 1,000 were to switch. Right. But it's very difficult to coordinate getting 1,000 people to switch from one network and use another network all at the same time. Right. But you don't want to switch just by yourself. You don't want to switch unless everybody switches. And if it's difficult to coordinate getting everybody to switch, then we end up being stuck with the one that we sort of randomly, you know, got to without, not because it's better, not because we like it, but just because of random events. But we get locked in to the wrong technologies, and not surprisingly, the remedy is more government intervention, of course. Right? This is supposed to be taken as an example of another way in which the market fails, okay, by the critics. So the critics say, well, you've got externalities and monopoly and all these other public goods as examples of market failure. Here's another one. An even more important source of market failure now is network effects and path dependence. Sometimes they call it the QWERTY effect, because one of the most famous examples of this is supposed to be the layout of the typewriter keyboard, a so-called QWERTY layout based on the alignment of keys. And there was a famous article published by the economic historian Paul David called Clio and the Economics of QWERTY, in which he argued that the history of the typing industry demonstrates that in markets for where technological standards are important and there are strong network effects, markets cannot be relied on to choose the most efficient or most effective goods and services. And he tells a story about the early days of the typewriter industry, when in fact there wasn't one standardized keyboard layout. Lots of typewriter manufacturers used all kinds of different layouts. You know, some were alphabetical, some were based on ergonomic studies, and there was no one established standard. Now, naturally, from the point of view of the typing industry as a whole, there's an advantage in having a common standard adopted, because presumably more people would be willing to buy a typewriter and train themselves to use it if they thought that those skills would be transferable from one machine to another machine to another machine. Okay. Sure, and right, if you know one particular method, it's easier to teach, and you could have schools and classes that just teach the one method or whatever, like we have for the most part today for touch type. There's some differences in how punctuation keys are aligned in different countries and so on, but everybody who uses the Roman alphabet basically uses the QWERTY model. Now, in David's story, in the early days of typing, to promote typewriters, typewriter manufacturers would put on these typing contests. They would go to a town and they would advertise, you know, a big, you know, town fair or whatever. We're going to have this typing contest in the town square, and a bunch of different typists would compete to see who could type the fastest. And it just so happened that there was one contestant who used the QWERTY keyboard and was very fast. Not because of the QWERTY layout is good, is better, but just for whatever reason, this fast guy happened to use QWERTY. So market participants mistakenly thought that, oh, that must be a good standard. And so some other manufacturers began to adopt the QWERTY format as well. And before long, through this process of path dependence, we ended up locked into QWERTY, where now pretty much everybody uses QWERTY, even though, according to David, all the experts agree that QWERTY is grossly inefficient relative to alternative layouts, the most famous being, I don't have a board, so-called a Dvorak layout. Some of you have heard of this, a different way you can organize your keys. You can do it easily on a computer now. And they say, well, the Dvorak keyboard, you can type faster with fewer errors, because the keys are laid out according to frequency of use. I mean, if you think about QWERTY, some of the things people don't like about it is, you know, your left thumb isn't used at all. Your right thumb does a lot, and your pinkies do a lot, you know, with the return key. And they say, you know, well, the pinky is small and weak. The pinky should do less. The thumb should do more, and there are different ways you can align the keys to make it faster. Other examples, I'll come back to QWERTY in a second. Some of you may remember the early days of the video cassette recorder. There were two competing formats. The one that emerged as the dominant format that we still have today, for those of you who know what a VCR is, looks like this. VHS. They also had another format called Betamax that was pushed by Sony that lost out in the competition. Of course, the modern, more recent equivalent of the battle between VHS and Betamax is Blu-ray versus HD DVD. Remember, until like 18 months ago, there were two competing high-definition DVD formats. Now the one that lost, HD DVD, is almost entirely forgotten, and Blu-ray is now a synonym for high-definition DVD. But until very recently, there were two competing formats. Right, and the idea is, again, manufacturers of high-definition video, they would like a common standard to emerge, because I don't know how many of you own a Blu-ray player. A few. I mean, not that many, right? Part of the reason is they're still expensive. And when these things first came out, a lot of people held back because they wanted to see who would win the format war, right? Because you don't want to end up with an orphan. Like, if you bought an HD DVD format player that doesn't play Blu-ray discs, now you're screwed. Okay, it's not worth anything. So people are waiting to see which will emerge as the dominant standard. I mean, the market doesn't really take off until a standard emerges. It was like that with VHS and Beta. If you read the literature in path dependence, people have come up with all kinds of seemingly bizarre examples of inefficient technologies that the market has foolishly chosen because of path dependence and network effects. Your AC over DC power. Some people have even argued that the internal combustion engine is less efficient than the steam engine. You know, we should have steam engines in our cars, but because of some random quirk of fate, we ended up stuck with internal combustion engines. And of course, there's a network effect there too, right? Because there's not just the car, but there's the network of gas stations, mechanics, parts, and so on. That's like, you know, it's like with electric cars, right? You need fueling stations and you need repair. You know, it takes a while for all the support infrastructure to emerge, so there's some path dependence there. Okay, is this a good argument for market failure? I don't think so, for several reasons. One reason we might just call imperfect knowledge, meaning, you know, we could imagine a case in which, you know, multiple technologies are available for sale. we're not really sure which one is going to end up being the best one. Like, I mean, maybe we don't know whether QWERTY or Dvorak is really better until we have lots of experience using them. And so maybe 20 years later, 100 years later, we say, gosh, I really wish the steam engine had emerged instead of the internal combustion engine as the dominant. Well, I mean, we all have ex post regret, right? I mean, that's only a market failure if, given the information that people had at the time, they made sort of the wrong decision. They made an inefficient decision. Okay, so, I mean, in the early days of many new technologies, nobody knows which one is going to end up being better for consumers. So, I mean, this doesn't really necessarily tell us anything specifically. One could also look at the political process. One could say, well, yeah, it's true that in markets characterized by network effects, the free market will often choose the technology that we decide later is not the most efficient one. You can ask, okay, well, what's the alternative to that? You know, it's like my grandmother says, getting old is not so bad once you consider the alternative. Okay, I mean, one alternative would be to let Congress decide. I mean, the government should decide what technology we use. Well, I mean, are government decision makers more or less likely to choose the optimal, efficient technology than market participants? Well, I mean, it doesn't take much imagination to imagine that, you know, lack of knowledge, improper incentives, and so on would lead government decision-making bodies often to, you know, favor some rich guy in their own district or whatever. I mean, we wouldn't expect the political process to lead to any improvement in the allocation in decisions about technology over the market. But finally, when you look at these histories, when you look at the typewriter market or the power market or the VHS market, it turns out that it's very difficult to identify any real-world example of where the market chose the wrong technology. Okay? First of all, we need to point out that what do we mean by the right technology or the wrong technology? Well, a lot of the critics in the network effects path dependence literature, when they say, well, this technology is worse than this other technology, they usually mean, you know, better or worse from a kind of engineering point of view. Okay, in other words, they'll say, for example, that if we go back to the video cassettes, that the Betamax technology is really better than the VHS technology. Why is it better? Well, number one, the cassettes were smaller, and so the machines, recording machines, could be smaller. And number two, the tapes held more information. It was a higher quality picture on these Betamax tapes than on the VHS tapes. But on the other hand, some of you may remember this, some of you old timers in the room may remember, the Betamax machines were also way more expensive than the VHS machines, and the tapes could hold less, you couldn't record as long. The first generation of Betamax tapes, I think you could only record 30 minutes, and the first generation of VHS tapes you could record for 2 hours, then they bumped it up to 6 with the extended play mode or whatever. So if you're a consumer of a video camera or a video cassette recorder in those days, you're choosing between a more expensive technology that is higher quality but records less time and a less expensive product that has lower quality but can record for more time. I mean, which of those is better or worse? Well, I mean, it doesn't matter what from an engineering point of view is the most technologically advanced or elegant solution. I mean, when we say better or worse from the market point of view, we mean from the perspective of consumers satisfying their needs, their wants. Okay, so what happened in that situation is consumers decided they preferred recording time over picture quality. They preferred recording time and price over picture quality and, you know, compactness of the equipment. In what way is that sort of the wrong decision? We have no way of saying that we should have chosen this other technology. Okay, so it's important in this literature, in the literature there's a lot of confusion between economic value, the ability of a good or service to satisfy consumer wants, and sort of engineering value or technological value. We don't care about that necessarily. Okay, also when you look at these case histories, they're all seriously flawed. So a famous paper by Stan Liebowitz and Steve Margolis called The Fable of the Keys. Some of you might recognize that as a play on a word play, a famous paper by Bernard Mandeville called The Fable of the Bees. So they reconstructed the history of the typewriter market by going back to the original sources, looking carefully at the historical record, and found that the version in Paul David's account was completely fallacious. That in fact, there were indeed lots of competing formats for typewriter keyboards, but there were different winners in these different typing contests, and for a long time it was unclear which keyboard layout people would prefer. Lots of them were in use by lots of different people. And the QWERTY layout, it turns out, when they went back and looked at, you know, where did Paul David get his information about the superiority of Dvorak? David's major, he hung his argument was based on a U.S. Navy study in the 1950s on different keyboard layouts, claiming that Dvorak was much faster and you could type with fewer errors and so on. The author of the Navy study was Mr. Dvorak, the creator of the Dvorak keyboard. Independent examinations and comparisons showed that there basically wasn't any difference in typing speed or ability according to which keyboard you use. Maybe very, very small differences. But the way ergonomic experts say that basically any keyboard layout is just as good as any other. The only differences are some of them you can learn faster than others. But a skilled typist can type about the same speed with about the same number of words per minute on pretty much any keyboard layout once they've learned them. So the point is, there's not a thing wrong with QWERTY relative to the alternatives. Okay. Same thing with, we just talked about the VHS and Beta example, AC, DC, all these other things, right? There are no obvious examples of where the technology that emerged ex post was actually inferior when looked at objectively from the point of view of its ability to satisfy consumer wants. Okay, some of you Mac evangelists are probably bristling right now, but in the Q&A period, we can talk about Mac versus PC, and I'll try to convince you that the Wintel platform is you know, every bit as efficient or effective as the Mac OS, and that the reason for the Wintel platform being dominant is not purely inefficient network effects, but that there are good reasons for it. Okay? Yeah, can you hold it off for just a minute? Because it's I just want to do one more slide and then I'll open it up for questions. But because we're close to the end, I want to talk just very, very briefly about the internet, only to make one or two points. Because I've got a piece on Mises.org about this that you can look at. That a lot of free market economists have pointed to the internet as sort of the quintessential example of spontaneous order. An example of how the free market, with the absence of state intervention, you know, can produce this magnificent product service that we all use. And I'm a little bit of a skeptic of that story, only because I think that story underestimates the degree to which the state was involved in the basic architecture of the network, right? I mean, the internet didn't emerge spontaneously on the free market. Its origins lie in Defense Department projects of the 1940s and 1950s. So it was the Defense Department and the RAND Corporation and other, and some universities on federal research grants. They were trying to design a network that would accomplish various objectives. The one that a lot of you have probably heard about is this idea of, you know, being able to survive a nuclear attack, right? So the basic architecture of a decentralized node-oriented network in which there's not just one path to get from, you know, Los Angeles to New York, but rather a piece of information, a packet of information, can travel a lot of different paths over different nodes before it's reassembled in its final destination. And one of the arguments for this decentralized, what they call a packet switching network, is that then you could make the network less vulnerable to a nuclear attack. There wouldn't be one central node or central trunk that the commies could take out with a nuclear bomb. There's also attempts to develop technologies that would allow mainframe computers to be time-shared among different users. People around the country could remotely log in to one of these big mainframes and run programs and so on. But the point I'm making is that even today, there's a sense in which we're burdened by the basic architecture of the network that was not designed by market participants seeking to earn profits, satisfy consumer wants, rather seeking to achieve particular political, military, defense, or research-related objectives. Okay, there was nothing commercial about the early history of the internet. Now, of course, since the mid-80s, when the commercial part of the internet took off by you know, jumping on top of the basic infrastructure that was already there. My claim is not that state intervention somehow, you know, generated the totality of the internet that we have today, only that there's a surprisingly strong role for that early state intervention, and that's a bad thing, right? That there's a certain kind of a path dependence that is harmful in this sense. One of my favorite quotes is from this thing called the Netbook, which is sort of kind of an unofficial open source history of the internet. There's this remarkable passage written by some network enthusiasts. They say, the current global computer network has been developed by scientists and researchers and users who were free of market forces. Wow, isn't that great? You know, because of the government oversight and subsidy of network development, these network pioneers were not under the time pressures or bottom line restraints that dominate commercial ventures. Therefore, they could contribute the time and labor needed to make sure the problems were solved. In other words, these early network pioneers were free from the constraint that whatever they produced had to satisfy consumer wants, right? Therefore, they produced a particular architecture that satisfied their wants and the wants of their federal funders. You know, is that good or bad? Well, it's not clear. But I think when we talk about the marvel of the internet and its example as spontaneous order and so on, you know, we have to be very careful not to commit the broken window fallacy, right? I mean, my conjecture is in the absence of the Defense Department's absence of DARPA, the RAND Corporation, and so on, we probably would still have a decentralized computer network of some kind, but it might be very different from the one we have now, right? And if it actually did emerge on the market, my conjecture is it would be better than the one we have now. Okay, I mean, remember, packet switching is good for certain uses, but it's not necessarily optimal for other uses. And some of you remember the earliest days of, like, you know, trying to do audio and video 10 years ago, even 5 years ago. You know, the quality was very poor, herky jerky, and so on. That's because packet switching networks are not optimized for real time communication. They're optimized for delayed communication. You know, because if you're sending an email and, you know, it takes a few extra seconds for this one packet to arrive and this other packet to arrive and them to be reassembled into the final message, it doesn't really matter. Okay, but for Skype or for real-time video, those lags can be important. And fortunately, we have compression technology that has, and of course, higher speed broadband that has rendered some of those problems less of a big deal than they used to be. But you can imagine, look, there were non-internet networks. Any of you guys remember, you know, CompuServe or the original AOL, these dial-up networks that originally were not connected to the internet at all and that sometimes added a connection to the wider internet. I mean, we could imagine a private for-profit network for for people at home or commercial networks within companies that might have eventually emerged to become something like the internet today. It would be vastly superior to the one we have. I have prepared some remarks on intellectual property, but we don't need to do that because you already heard all that from Kinsella. Okay, some more IP stuff. So, the bottom line is that the information technology sector does have some interesting and unusual characteristics. You know, information goods, network effects are clearly important, though they're not really new. But, you know, the basic laws of economics, what you learn in Menger, von Bawerk, Mises, Hayek, Rothbard, and so on, they still apply. Okay, we don't need a new body of economic theory to handle these new phenomena. The basic edifice of Austrian economics still works plenty well. Thank you.